From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Should employers be able to ask job seekers if they have a criminal record early in the application process? That's the fundamental question behind the Ban the Box movement, so dubbed due to the box on a job application that people are required to check if they have any criminal history. So far, 19 states have adopted such legislation, and Florida lawmakers will take up such a bill in 2016. We'll take a closer look. Plus, Holocaust survivor, author, and educator Ava Moses Kaur comes to Florida Gulf Coast University for a speaking event next week. Kaur and her twin sister Miriam were among the roughly 3,000 children at the Auschwitz Nazi concentration camp, subjected to horrific genetic experiments under the direction of Nazi physician Dr. Josef Mengele. We'll hear details of Kaur's story of survival in her own words. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. Holocaust survivor, author, public speaker, human rights activist, and educator Ava Moses Kaur will tell her story at Florida Gulf Coast University November 23rd. At the age of 10, Kaur was sent to the Nazis' Auschwitz concentration camp, where her parents and two older sisters were killed. Ava and her twin sister Miriam became part of a group of about 3,000 children who were abused in horrific genetic experiments under the direction of Dr. Josef Mengele. They were among the roughly 200 children found alive when the Soviet Army liberated the camp in 1945, most of whom had been Mengele twins. Nearly four decades later, Ava Kaur founded CANDLES, meaning Children of Auschwitz Nazi Deadly Lab Experiments Survivors, and with Miriam's help, reconnected 122 other Mengele twin survivors around the world. In 1995, Kaur founded the CANDLES Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Terre Haute, Indiana. That year, she also wrote and published her account of survival in the book Echoes from Auschwitz, Dr. Mengele's Twins, the story of Ava and Miriam Moses. Kaur has also become known as a forgiveness advocate. 50 years after the liberation of Auschwitz, she offered her forgiveness to the Nazis as an act of self-healing and to free herself of victim status. I recently spoke with Kaur in advance of her trip to Southwest Florida to hear details of her story of survival. We began our talk with a look at her life as a very young child in Romania, just before her village was occupied by a Hungarian Nazi armed guard. Let's hear that conversation now.
Yeah, I was 6 years old when we lived in this tiny village of 100 families, when the Hungarians occupied the village. Up to that time, it was Romania. And with the occupation, everything changed. Harassment and hatred of the Jews was widespread, and it was part of the daily rule. To call us dirty Jews, it was nothing unusual. The kids were taught to do that too. And different rules and different laws were passed against us to make our lives more difficult. While at home, things were pretty good, but my parents tried to protect us from all the outside world, except it was impossible. And that harassment and victimization has increased until March of 1944, by which time I was 10, we were taken to a regional ghetto. And I believe that throughout Europe, the Nazis had ghettos. These were actual prisons surrounded by or by tall brick walls. In our case, it was a tall barbed wire fence. The conditions in the ghetto were horrific. There was no building. We built our tent out of sheet and blankets. And the head of every family was taken in for interrogation. My father was brought back on a stretcher with bleeding wood marks, and all his fingernails and toenails were burned because they kept asking him where he hid all his gold and silver, and he kept telling them the truth, that he was a farmer, and he put all his money in land, but they didn't believe him. At the end of 2.5 months, they told us to leave all our belongings behind because they are taking us to Hungary to a labor camp, and the place will have everything we needed. So we were loaded onto cattle cars, about 100 people to a cattle car. This was the last week in May. I believe that 10 days later, D-Day was happening, but we didn't know anything of that, of course. The cattle car had no room even to sit, so they're mostly standing and leaning against one another. The train moved very fast. 4 days later, it stopped in a place, and we asked for water, and we heard lots of Germans yelling orders outside. The cattle car doors opened. Thousands of people poured out of the cattle car onto a little strip of land called the selection platform, because people were selected to live or to die. In my opinion, there is no other strip of land anywhere on the face of this earth that has witnessed so many millions of people being ripped apart from their families forever.
And the selection platform was this the last time you saw your older sisters and your father?
We were ripped apart from the family within 30 minutes. Miriam and I no longer had a family. We were all alone, and we had no idea what would become of us. We became part of a group of little girls, all twins. In our group, there were 13 sets. And then we were taken to a processing center, but sat most of the day naked. And it was only late in the afternoon when our processing began. We were given short haircuts. Our dresses were marked with a red cross in the back. And we were tattooed. And I became capital A-7063. Miriam became capital A-7064. Auschwitz was the only Nazi camp that tattooed its inmates. My husband, for instance, is a four-year survivor of Buchenwald, but he does not have a tattoo. Once we were processed, we were taken to our barrack, filthy, crude, three-story high bunk beds in a modular horse barn. I don't think that human beings can cope with a traumatic day like we did, and I could not sleep on my bunk bed. But as I was tossing and turning, I noticed something big and dark on the floor. I counted them. It was a whole parade of very big rats. And we got really scared of the rats. We went to the train. When we entered the place, there on the filthy latrine floor, I saw the corpses of three children. This is when I realized that in this place, children were dying, and made my first silent pledge that I would do anything and everything within my power to make sure that Miriam and I will survive and walk out of this camp alive. Our daily routine, after roll call and Mengele's counting us to know every morning how many guinea pigs he had, I will give you a sentence that will describe our condition. In our barrack, we were little girls between the ages of 2 and 16. We were huddling in our filthy bunk beds, crawling with lice and rats. We were starved for food. Starvation in Auschwitz was a very big problem. We were starved for human kindness, and we were starved for the love of the mothers and fathers that we once had. We had no rights, but we had a fierce determination to live one more day, survive one more experiment. We were used in two types of experiments. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we would be placed naked in a room, big room, about 50 to 100 twins at a time. They would count and measure every part of my body, comparing it to my twin sister, and then comparing it to charts. These experiments were not dangerous, but they were unbelievably demeaning. And even in Auschwitz, I had trouble coping with it. On alternate days, on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, we would be taken to another lab that I call the Broad Lab. There, they would tie both of my arms to restrict the blood flow, take a lot of blood from my left arm, and give me a minimum of 5 injections into my right arm. Those were the deadly ones. After one of those injections, I became very ill with a very high fever, a fact I tried to hide. In addition to that, my legs were swollen and painful, and I had huge red spots on my body. The next visit to the blood lab, they did not tie my arms for blood taking. Instead of that, they measured my fever, and I knew I was in trouble. I was immediately taken to the hospital, which was an other barrack, but it was filled with people who looked more dead than alive. Next morning, Dr. Mengele came in with 4 other doctors. He never examined me. All he did, he looked at my fever chart, and then he declared, laughing sarcastically. He said, "Too bad. She's so young, she has only 2 weeks to live." I knew he was right, but I refused to die. For the following 2 weeks, I have only one clear memory. I remember crawling on the barrack floor because I no longer could walk, and I was crawling to reach a faucet with water at the other end of the barrack. And as I was crawling, I would fade in and out of consciousness, and I kept telling myself, "I must survive, I must survive." After 2 weeks, my fever broke, and I immediately felt a lot stronger and a lot better. It took me another 3 weeks before I was released and reunited with my twin sister, Miriam. But Miriam looked very sick, and I asked her what on earth happened to her that she looked so sick. She said, "I cannot talk about it. I will not talk about it." And Miriam and I never talked about Auschwitz until 1985. As we found out years later, Miriam got married in 1958 in Israel to an Israeli, expected her first baby in 1960, and she developed severe kidney infections that did not respond to any antibiotic. The second pregnancy in 1963, the infection got worse, and the Israeli doctors were lost for answers. They tried to figure out, they asked me, could I possibly find the files from Auschwitz so they could figure out what Miriam was injected with that combined it with the anti-rejection medication to create the cancerous polyps. We never found our files. We never found out what was injected into our bodies.
What would happen to any children who tried to resist, or was that just not even an option?
I want you to realize that all around you is death,
right.
Military people, innocent victims who look like skeletons, and tall barbed wire fences that are filled with high voltage. Exactly where on earth do you think you can go? Survival was very clear. Was the only way to survive is to cooperate with their experiments. There was no doubt in my mind, and I never even tried it, but I don't think that they would have kept me alive if I did not cooperate. I was actually convinced that they would not keep me alive.
Did you know, or do you feel reasonably certain that if you had died, that they would have killed your sister also?
Well, I know for a fact, because actually what killed most of the twins were the experiment. They, according to the Auschwitz Museum, they had 1,500 sets of twins, which makes 3,000 individuals. The estimated number of individuals that survived, who survived, is 250 individuals. So from the 3,000, only 250 survived. They were not interested in keeping us alive. They were interested in doing the experiment. So in my case, from what I understood, would I have died? Miriam would have immediately killed with an injection to the heart, and the Mengele would have done the comparative autopsies. In normal life, you cannot do that, but in Auschwitz, everything was possible. So, yeah, I am 100% convinced that if I would have died, she would have died immediately. Actually, that was the purpose of the experiment, to kill us, but then to see how a disease or a germ worked, to compare it to my twin sister.
And, today we know about some of these very, really, really terrible cases of what Dr. Mengele did. I mean, everything, of course, was terrible, but...
But I want to tell you something.
Yes.
Well, everybody thinks that Mengele was a monster. In some way, he was. But did you know, and does your audience know, that the experiments were conducted and supervised by the most prestigious German scientific institution in Berlin, called the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Genetic Studies? I lectured at the institute in 2001, 2005, 2009, and yes, they had a conference because they wanted to collect information from the survivors, since their data that was at the institute when the Americans took over for the American sector disappeared. So there are a lot of speculations what happened to our files. But that is today. It's called the Max Planck Society, and anybody should be interested in further researching the experiment done by Mengele, all one needs to do is Google Nazi medical experiments, and it will pop up. There is a lot of information on it. Now, I believe that this was the purpose for the experiment, to ultimately figure out how the germs work. One of the purposes, not the only one.
I'd read that one of Dr. Mengele's particular interests was people with a heterochromia iridium, people with two different eye colors. Is that something that you or Miriam had?
No. Those twins were all gypsy twins. I never saw any of the Mengele twins, because the gypsy twins were kept in separate barracks. We knew that they existed, but I have never seen any of them. And among gypsies, that was more prevalent, but these are also twins. So they did a lot of experiments on the gypsy twins, but the gypsy twins, actually, they're all gassed to death sometime, I believe, in September of 1944 or so. We were not supposed to stay alive. I found in Auschwitz a list of the few twins who survived, with my name on it. But the order came down from Berlin to shut down the gas chambers and crematoriums, and that is the way I survived. So it was all a lot of luck and an enormous will to live. That is what kept us alive.
Well, maybe we can fast forward a little bit here to a.
Well, I just want to tell you, Orient, that in addition to my lecturing, I talk about why I tell them my story of the important life lessons that I have learned. And I will just enumerate them. One, never ever give up on yourself. Two, prejudice was one of the reasons that Hitler succeeded, and prejudice is still with us today. Three, forgive your worst enemy. It will heal your soul, and it will set you free.
All right, that's a wonderful message. That's a really great message. Can you tell me a little bit about life in Israel when you finally made it there?
Well, it was probably the first time in my life that I was not afraid that I would be killed because I was Jewish. Up to that time, because after the war, we went back to Romania, but Romania became communist. And there was nothing that their fancy posters or publicity said, freedom, brotherhood, as equality. That was a complete lie. And so in Romania, when we arrived in Israel, I was 16 years old, and I could sleep without the fear of persecution. We were in agricultural school where we worked 4 hours a day and we went to school 4 hours a day. And it was a wonderful experience. Then when we turned 18, we were drafted into the Israeli army. Miriam studied and became a nurse, registered nurse. I was sent to engineering corps. I became a draftsman and stayed in the Israeli army 8 years, reaching the rank of sergeant major. I was stationed in Tel Aviv. In 1960, I met an American tourist from Terre Haute, Indiana, also a survivor who was liberated in Buchenwald by an American lieutenant colonel from Terre Haute, Indiana. And he asked Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Neff if he could get his help to come to the United States because he really, really liked the Americans. And Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Neff helped him come to Terre Haute, Indiana. He never wanted to live anywhere else. So when I married him in 1960, I came from Tel Aviv to Terre Haute. And life, it was quite a jump. But Miriam stayed in Israel, and I talked about her a little bit. And she ultimately died June 6, 1993.
And I understand that she died following a battle with cancer. Again, not knowing what chemicals you were exposed to, injected with.
I didn't get into all the details.
Oh, sure, sure.
In 1987, her kidneys failed, at which time I donated one of my kidneys. At that hospital near Tel Aviv, they had 2,000 survivors of transplanted kidneys. All of them were given anti-rejection medication, as did my sister. She was the only one to develop cancerous polyps a year after the transplant. And this is why the doctors in Israel kept urging me to try to find our files. I am still looking for them, okay? We never found them. Miriam's cancer metastasized throughout her body, and she died June 6, 1993. Now, if she wouldn't have had a transplanted kidney, she would not have needed the anti-rejection medication.
Right, right.
But she did get the anti-rejection medication, and unfortunately, she did develop the cancer.
Do you think it's likely that these records maybe just don't exist? Perhaps they were destroyed.
I believe it with every ounce of my being that Mengele would not have let the record be destroyed. I personally believe that the United States, under the operation of Paperclip, which we know that they brought in rocket scientists from Germany why not expert in germ warfare? You inject one twin with the germ, and the other, when the twin dies, you kill the other one, and you do the comparative autopsies. In with the Cold War, United States wanted to have any extra information that would help with that idea. But of course, I cannot prove it because the records disappeared.
Well, can we talk a bit about when you started Candles and sort of what prompted you to first start looking for these other twins?
I would begin lecturing, and people would ask me about the experiment, and all I was aware of was my own experiment. So I wondered, after reading a few books about Mengele and not getting any information about the experiment, because all it had in it was Mengele did experiment on twins. I already knew that. So there I thought, if I could find all these children who were liberated, we knew that they lived somewhere, but where? And so I began a big campaign in trying to get the attention of the media, people like you, but at the time nobody wanted to talk to me, to try to publicize that we were looking for the other twins. 6 years later, and I didn't stop, with the help of my sister in Israel and the help of my brother-in-law, who was a journalist, we put in an advertisement in one of the Israeli papers, Ma'ariv, and with that we located within 1 week 80 Mengele twins, and then the media covered our story, and we found another 42. So we found a total of 122 surviving twins living in 10 countries and 4 continents. So it was a very complicated organization from the beginning.
Were you happy to, you know, be able to find as many as you were?
I was looking for them everywhere. We found a few more. And I think that there still are probably more twins alive that did not come forward because they didn't want to remember the details of their lives in the camp.
And you were saying even you and your sister for years didn't speak about what happened.
No, we did not. We did not. There was not an issue that we would discuss.
Thank you so much for speaking with
me. Thank you.
That was Holocaust survivor, Mengele twin, human rights activist, author, and educator Ava Moses Kaur. Florida Gulf Coast University's Office of Community Outreach and the Center for Judaic, Holocaust, and Genocide Studies will host a talk by Ava Kaur on Monday, November 23rd at 5:30 in the Cohen Center Ballroom. The event is free and open to the public. For more details, visit fgcu.edu/community-outreach. That's all the time we have. There's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers Richard Chinqui and Topher Forges. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.